sometimes the research that we like to do, if it focuses on a specific population, some people might try to talk you out of it, or, you know, have you water it down or tell you that you should look more broadly. But your voice matters. Yes, you can learn from others and, you know, consider other perspectives, as you should. However, what you have to say matters, and you're there for a reason. So just believe it and stand firm and in your thoughts, and don't be afraid to speak up. If you're wrong, someone will correct you. We all get it wrong sometimes, but just believe that you belong in those rooms, because you do.
PhD is short for Doctor of Philosophy. This podcast shares tips of real-life doctoral students who will eventually defend a dissertation at the end of their academic journey. In this special edition of PhD Tips, we are joined by a special guest who will share their wisdom and 5 tips for students looking to successfully complete a PhD. If you have been following the ride, thank you for tuning back in. And if you are new, welcome to PhD Tips. Lachey Williams, originally from Metro Atlanta, is a second-year doctoral candidate at Drexel University, studying clinical psychology with an emphasis in pediatric neuropsychology. She earned her Bachelor's of Science in Psychology and Biology at the University of Georgia, as well as her Master's of Science in Clinical Psychology at Barry University. Her research interests include investigating disparities in the detection of neurodevelopment disorders such as autism. Please help me in welcoming Lachey Williams.
Right, we're live. So Lachey Williams is on the podcast, and I want to say thank you for coming. I DM'd you randomly, so
thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's always a shot in the dark. And for everyone that comes on to the podcast, I let them know that the information that you provide is not for me per se. Although I'm in my PhD program, and I'll use all the information you give, but I hope this podcast is sort of a North Star for the culture. And I assume you know what the culture is.
I do.
If you don't identify with the culture, then it's probably not for you. Cool. So let people know who you are and, you know, what you're studying and what year you're in.
Sure. So I'm Lachey Williams. I am a second year doctoral candidate. I actually took comps a year early, so I'm happy to be able to make that switch from student to candidate. And I'm studying clinical psychology at Drexel University. I have sort of concentrations in 2 different areas, child psychology and neuropsychology. So all of that is with the ultimate goal of becoming a pediatric neuropsychologist. So my research interests generally include looking at the disparities in how we detect neurodevelopmental disorders like autism and ADHD. And I'm really interested in, like, where we go wrong at any point in the continuum, from the point they go to the doctor, to our screening tools, to our assessments as psychologists. So anywhere along that line that we get it wrong, I want to figure out how to fix it.
Yeah, neuropsychology, that's... anything neural to me is like, ooh.
Oh, is it?
That's intense.
It's so not. It's super interesting. And, like, it really just marries, like, you know, the brain and the behavior, looking at, like, a little bit of biology and some psychology. So it's like the best of both worlds without having to go full neuroscience.
Yeah. Or neurosurgeon, right?
Yeah. Now that's intense.
Yeah, neurosurgery. Yes, yeah, that's intense. I remember watching House a bunch, and all of this seemed to jumble together. But actually, watching House helps you figure out there's a lot to all of this, you know, stuff in health and healthcare. And so, yeah. So my last guest, Jay Withers. He's in psychology as well, and he corrected me to remind me that, as right now, as he's a student, he should be referenced as healthcare professional in training. Is that the same for you? Is that how they tell you to represent yourself?
Yeah, so there's different ways. The key there is not to call us psychologists because you cannot have that title at this point. We're sort of called trainees or clinicians, anything that sort of signifies that we're working under someone else's license.
Okay, yeah. Oh, that's how that works too. See, yep. That's something new every day. So like if you can't come up with some theory or some great learning now, then you can't actually own it? Is that how it works?
No, right so you can own it. So I guess there's two different, psychology is a little bit of a weird field in terms of PhD, because usually, you know, I guess in some fields you do strictly science, whereas in fields like psychology, you're doing science and clinical work. So on the science side of things, if you come up with some groundbreaking, earth-shattering stuff, you are a scientist. You know, from the moment that you start doing science and doing your research, you're a scientist. So you can claim it, you know, when you publish, you can, you know, put, if it's your work, you can put yourself as first author. But in terms of clinical work, you know, we cannot administer any type of therapy or assessment or diagnoses without someone above us that's licensed signing off on that. So we never want to misrepresent and say like, you know, I'm giving psychological advice, because that is completely unethical and we are not supposed to do it.
It'll come for you. Would your school throw you out, or it's like
probably so. And if not, they put me on some type of serious probation.
Oh man. Well, let's not make that mistake here.
Yeah, you won't. No worries.
Yeah. All right, cool. This next question is about, you know, what's your academic journey? And you can go back as far as you want. You know, you can go all the way to pre-K. And you know, the reason why I ask this question is I want, because, you know, people that I have on the podcast, it's like, you know, you're either a doc student, PhD student, or studying medicine. It's like you're a legend. You're an icon living. It's like this prestigious thing. But you know, at the end of the day, we're all just people. So, you know, so if you could just share your academic journey and kind of what led you to the space that you're in now for the listeners.
Absolutely. So I'll start. First, I want to say I'm not a legend at all. I have not done anything to earn that status. I'll start in high school. I won't go all the way back to pre-K, but I feel like I had a little bit of what I used to think was an unconventional journey to PhD. But the longer that I'm in this space, I realize that it's really not all that unconventional at all. It's just maybe not talked about. So, you know, I knew pretty early on that I wanted to be in mental health. When I was in high school, I knew going into college, I was going to major in psychology, but I am a first-gen student. And so, you know, I was sort of trying to figure out my way on my own. And I knew, the one thing I knew going in was with psychology, you need a terminal degree. So you're either going to go to med school or you're going to go to grad school. I didn't know anything about grad school, but I knew kind of like med school, you go for 4 years, you study medicine, and you get paid a lot of money when you're done. So I was like, I have to go to school for a bunch of years. I'm going to be a medical doctor. So I went into college as a psychology major with pre-medical intent. And, you know, as I was cycling through my classes, there were some classes that I really liked, like the neurobiologies and the cognitive neuropsychs. And then there were some classes that just didn't like me, like chemistry, organic chemistry, just wasn't working out too great. But, you know, I was really intent on finishing out that pre-med intent. And so a lot of those classes actually crossed over. So because I was interested in those sort of crossover classes between psychology and biology, I actually added a second major of biology. And so I finished both majors, but I didn't really do that great in my biology major at all. You know, my psych grades were great, like A's and B's, never got anything bad in psych. But in biology, it was really variable. So I had some A's, some B's, some C's, a couple D's, failed O-Chem a couple times. You know, it was really rough. So, but I did finish. And so when I came out, you know, I guess, let me back up. Somewhere between my third and fourth year, I interned at a hospital and I figured out that I didn't want to be a psychiatrist. Actually, I didn't like it. And that's not what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So I decided, you know, I got to change course and figure out this grad school thing. So I really didn't get it still at that point. You know, it's like you said, it's like this like mythical thing. Like, what is this? These people are so smart, but yeah, you don't really know how to get there. And so I didn't have a lot of guidance. So I graduated with a pretty trashy GPA. Not within my psych major. That was solid, but you know, overall, it was just not looking too hot. So I actually started interning at a private practice in Atlanta that was doing psychological assessment. And I sort of worked my way up from the intern to being able to, you know, administer some tests and score things under supervision, of course. And from there, I was hooked up with a lab that, you know, they kind of guided me and they knew I wanted to get into PhD, but I had atrocious grades and didn't know what I was doing. So, you know, there was a lab that was hiring in Atlanta. They were hiring for a research study to do assessment. And so I was hired on that study, and that lab was actually headed by my current PhD advisor. So this was like, I don't know, five or six years ago that I actually met her. Mm-hmm. And so I worked for her, and she really, you know, took me in under her wing and mentored me and told me, like, you know, you got to get research to get into a PhD. You need experience, right, and you need good GRE scores. And these are the things you need. So she mentored me up, you know, dusted me right on off, and polished this, you know, very dark gem. And I ultimately decided, in order to prove myself academically, I wanted to get my master's degree to show, you know, admissions committees that I was as smart as I was saying I was. So I went back to school, did my master's for 2 years in Miami while working full time as a research coordinator to get more research experience. And then I applied again. Well, not again. That was my first time applying. So I applied in 2018 and I got into school. So here we are.
Just fell into place, right?
Literally, you know, the stars just literally all aligned all along my journey. And it was because I had a lot of help. So I love, you know, when people do podcasts or, you know, it give any type of advice to students who might not have the resources to know what to do. I'm all on board for it.
Yep, exactly. Because especially, you know, one of the biggest reason why I made this is, you know, as I go into my own program, I realize, I am tripping, stumbling, crawling my way through just the application process. I don't know what's about to come. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to create a space that people that look like us in our community, if they decide they want to do a PhD program or after, you know, college or after their grad program, then maybe they can listen in and say, here are some nuggets of information that they can use. Yeah. So, you know, so this is perfect. I had a question. So you said you were in Miami studying, doing your grad program, yeah, and you're still doing research with the private practice in Atlanta?
So I wasn't working there anymore. Actually, when I moved to Miami, I went to a master's program that allowed, they had night classes. And but it was full time. So I went to school from like 6 to 9 p.m. at night. And then during the day, I was a research coordinator at University of Miami in one of the labs there from like 9 to 5 every day. So I was doing double duty, but, you know, it was worth it in the end.
Yeah, exactly. You're here.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. So that's very insightful. So a little bit about you. So, you know, you're a second year, mm-hmm, and congratulations.
Thanks.
And so I'm wondering, you know, maybe in a few years when you finish, you can come back and talk about this, but can you give us sort of like an executive summary, and you kind of give us a glimpse of what your research is, your research interests are, about what your dissertation writing or what your dissertation might be when it's complete, or just maybe the key findings that you are going to be able to defend in your, you know, dissertation?
Yeah, so I haven't actually, I guess, officially started my dissertation yet because for multiple reasons, but as we know, we're like in the middle of a shutdown, and my lab does really clinical things. So we see really little babies, and we do early detection of autism. So right now we're not seeing any kids because of coronavirus. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, you know, like I said, I'm interested in the disparities at any point. And so I think, you know, I've done some research already and looking at, you know, how doctors identify kids differently and how, you know, our screeners are identifying kids differently. I think for my dissertation, the direction that I'm going to go in is this concept I'm really interested in called cognitive flexibility. And it's like basically, you know, how you are able to switch your mind to do different things or switch your mind to different tasks. And so, you know, we know that that's, you know, it's an area of weakness in individuals with neurodevelopmental disabilities. And so I am interested to see, what is that developmental trajectory look like in people with autism? Does it develop the same way as neurotypical individuals? And then is there a cultural aspect to it? Because there's some literature out there that suggests that maybe it doesn't develop like in a linear age-wise fashion as we would expect across cultures, that, you know, there's some type of cultural SES or race component that might, you know, change that trajectory. So I'm really interested in bringing the culture and, you know, autism and like the neuropsych all together. I just want to marry it all for my dissertation. So I haven't fully pitched the idea to my mentor yet. She's heard it briefly, but we'll see, you know, what she thinks about it.
Yeah, that's cool. And so I'm curious about, because, you know, if you're doing a PhD, you're doing research, and I'm wondering, so in that interest of trying to find the, you know, the point in making decisions differently, what you just spoke about, like, how do you do that research? Is it you and your team go to like daycares and just observe students, young people, or how is the research actually done?
Yeah, so it can be done a number of ways. So usually, you know, you pick a mentor that is doing something you're interested in and do something under their umbrella, unless you are fortunate enough to get your own grant, which, you know, fingers crossed, maybe you will be. Yeah. So my mentor has done a lot of work with screening. So she created a screener years ago, I think for her dissertation, to screen individuals for autism, really young, because at that time, there was and still now, but especially at that time, there was a big push to decrease the age of diagnosis because we were diagnosing kids too late. And so essentially what we have in our labs is, you know, we have a bunch of practices, pediatric practices or hospitals signed on, and they use the screener and they screen the kids that come in for normal, like, well, baby visits. So, you know, you have a kid, you take your kid to the doctor because that's the normal thing to do. And when you go to the doctor for a checkup, you get this screener. So we get the results of those screeners. And if a child's flagged, then we bring them in for an evaluation if they, you know, if they consent to it. So we do full on diagnostic assessments in our lab. So we have, like, you know, the recruiting is already set in place for me. I don't have to do that because she did the legwork. But, you know, we get the kids. I see at the point that we get the kids in for assessments, I see the families. And then, you know, we do the measures to diagnose. And then there's also an intervention component that I'm not really involved in. I'm pretty blind to it. But, you know, we have a treatment study as well, RCT going. So it's, you know, it can happen a number of ways. Some people go in school, some people start just at the point of assessment. But we have a really nice system, I think, where we can start, you know, at the doctor's office and then see how it goes when they come to us and then see how it goes in intervention. So we've got a nice little setup going.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, so research is done so many different ways that as I'm paying attention to it, it's, you know, it's done so many different ways. So that's cool. Thanks for that.
Of course.
Before you give your tips, because I know you're dying to give your tips, I'm wondering, you know, and it's very valuable that I think it's going to be very valuable for the people listening to the podcast, because mostly people who are listening to this podcast are people who are looking to do a PhD program, or they're really gearing up to start considering thinking about applying. Yeah. And you just finished your first year successfully. And so, like, what was like the typical day like for you in year one, and kind of what are you expecting? Well, it's kind of with the grain of salt for this year because
yeah.
But so, like, how was this last year?
Yeah, so it was good. You know, I think there's a lot of like fear going into year one about this big transition and what it's going to be like. But I would say like it went pretty smoothly and I'm really glad about it. So in my program, and probably most programs, you know, you have classes, but classes are not really, I guess, the primary focus of PhD. Is more research oriented. But we do have, you know, coursework for the first couple of years. So I had classes on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. They keep those days set because we do clinical work. So they like to leave the rest of our week open. I was in the lab on pretty much every other day, but my lab is clinical in nature. So essentially, you know, I would go in, like, say, on a Monday morning and see a family from 9 a.m. to maybe 3 p.m. We do a full evaluation and feedback. And then I would score everything and write the report. I write reports from home just because I like to have different environments. So I go home, maybe write a report that takes maybe 4 hours. So I would see two, sometimes three, but hopefully not more than two kids in a week. And then I would have, you know, time dedicated to just doing purely research during that week as well. So it was really flexible, like basically wherever I could fit things in. My assessment schedule was set. So I knew going into the week, like I have a kid on Monday and a kid on Thursday. But aside from that, like it's pretty flexible. Now, second year is a little different. And I know like it is kind of in the balance because of coronavirus. But interestingly enough, I actually this week was my first week back out. So second year, I know, it's pretty terrifying. Second year is in our program, you know, when you sometimes it can go either second or third. But for me in second year is when I start externship. So you get like this external rotation of clinical work. And so now I have 2 days out of the week dedicated to going to an external site to get clinical hours and get experience. Then I don't have any classes in the summer, but once the fall hits, I'll have, you know, classes on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. And then I'll also be in my lab doing some assessments and some research. So it's some of it's flexible, some of it's set, but it kind of varies depending on, like, you know, most clinical work, like when clients can come in, you sort of are at their mercy a little bit. So it's a full schedule, but it's manageable if you just have, you know, a lot of organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And do you think, because a lot of people are, they always say, oh, you know, PhD programs, I can just go straight in, you know, because you don't have to do a master's. But mm-hmm. what I typically tell people is, because in my own experience, my graduate program really supported me in learning how to write better. Mm-hmm. And if not better, write more. Yeah. And read more. So like for your preparation to successfully move swiftly through your first year program, you know, what do you think prepared you to do it so swiftly?
I think it was the research experience, honestly. You know, I think most fields, but especially like I can only really speak to mine because I guess that's the only one I'm in. But I feel like most fields are this way. So you can correct me if I'm wrong. You can go straight through, right? But a lot of programs value real world experience first. Mm-hmm. So as opposed to like, you know, graduating undergrad and then just going straight through, which is totally possible and everybody has their own path. A lot of programs really value that you get out in the real world and get some experience. So, you know, in my case, getting that research experience was really important and pivotal. I think it, you know, I think I had a slower learning curve than sometimes people have. And, you know, that's not to say I had the fastest learning curve. Like, you know, I probably was somewhere in the middle, but, you know, I was able to get in, read those articles really easily, you know, put together presentations pretty easily because I had already been doing it in these research labs that I worked in before. So this wasn't really my first rodeo. It was more so, you know, handling that with handling classes, you know, being an adult and paying bills on your stipend, like just putting it all together. But I mm-hmm. think getting that experience before you go in will really prepare you and sort of mature you in the way that you think about how you want to approach your PhD. I think you're on mute, Cliff.
Oh, yes, I am. I was talking. and I have another question to come because yeah. of what you just said. And these are questions that are not prepared. That's because okay. you saying things that are on point. You mentioned the stipend, the notorious stipend. How does it work in your case? And if you know more generally how it might work in PhD programs, can you share about that too?
Yeah, so your stipend is what, it's basically your pay. It's what your program gives you to be able to live and to go to class and do your research. So many PhD programs do not allow you to work because, you know, it basically is like a full-time job during doing your PhD. So the way that stipend, I guess, really is quantified is when you go to a program that has full funding, you usually are either on a teaching assistantship or research assistantship. So I'm on a research assistantship, which means that I have 20 hours a week dedicated to my lab, whether that's doing like sitting down and doing data, writing manuscripts, or seeing clients. Like that's my 20 hours dedicated. And a lot of the times, I don't want to instill this in you, which I'll talk about later, but sometimes it can be more than 20 hours. Sometimes it might be lighter, but you're dedicated for those 20. And if you're on teaching assistantship, then you're usually a TA. So you help professors TA classes, just like in undergrad when you had a TA that sort of graded things and answered questions or had office hours. That would be your dedicated time. And the stipend's very low usually, especially for a grown adult. But I think the key is to really budget, when you're choosing programs, see where the city is, what's the cost of living, if you can make it work, and you know what your standard of living is and how much you're willing to flex on that. You're gonna have to flex on something because it's not a lot of money, but it's doable. People do it all the time. So
Cool. So I think I'm encroaching on your tips. So let's just get there.
totally fine.
So I think people are going to really appreciate your tips because you have a particular focus. And Drexel is a unique university. Your experience as a Black woman doing research is. It's going to be very inspiring for a lot of young women looking to do PhD program. Usually it's like people usually give 5 tips, but if you want to, you know, keep rolling, you can keep rolling. But you can also do less than 5 too. So if there's any tips you would want to give someone looking to do a PhD program or someone currently in their PhD program and they want to be successful, have a successful finish, what would those tips be?
So I've got 5 because if I didn't set a limit, I'd talk all day and then you'd have to put me off. So I sort of tried to think of tips that are helpful for different points along the journey. So the first one's like all encompassing time management. You hear this all the time. I feel like this is like the most cliche advice. Like you need to know how to manage your time. But it's so true, especially for PhD, because it is a lot more flexible in my experience. My program is really good about having our classes on the same 2 days. So we really only have to worry about the other 3 days out of the week. But a lot of the times it's going to be, you know, based on how you choose to manage your schedule. You might have a lot of open time, but you get this idea that it's free time, but it's not really free time. You know, you look up and then your time's gone and you don't have any research to show for it. So time management's a huge one to make sure you're getting all of your work done, meeting all of your expectations, and also carving out time for yourself. So get you a good planner if that's your thing. I personally am I'm a Google girl, so I love Google calendars. It's like my lifeline. I schedule everything, even if I need to like take out the trash. I'm like, 10:15 a.m. Take the trash. No, I don't. But close to it. And I also really love the Google Gmail has this like task list thing where you can just, you know, make a to-do list and check it off as you go. So those are my tools, but find something that works for you because that's the biggest piece of advice that I have is time management. Mm-hmm. So number 2. Plan ahead. And this can go for anyone like trying to get into school or if you're already in school, it's really important to have short and long-term goals. So some people will say, I've heard a lot in my first year, like, oh, you don't have to worry about that because that's 4 or 5 years out or that's in 10 years. But the reality is the way that PhD is set up, especially if you want a career in academia, you should be thinking about these things, maybe not as neurotically as I do. But you need to have short-term goals and long-term goals. So for example, if you know you want to be a professor at the end of your PhD journey, you need to know, you know, competitive applicants for professorship. How many publications in my field do they usually have? What types of experiences do they usually have? Because if you wait until you're at the end of your program and you're getting ready to apply, you may not be a competitive applicant if you haven't looked at those things you need to do along the way, but then making sure that you also break them down. So for example, if you know you need 10 publications, this is a random number, so no one be alarmed. But if you know you need 10 publications to get the job you want, breaking that down, like, okay, this year I need to shoot for 2 publications, and then next year I'll shoot for this number. Yeah. So just have short and long-term goals to keep you on track. Number 3, boundaries. Make sure you set boundaries. So I sort of alluded to this earlier in that, you know, your stipend has you set up for contracted 20 hours a week of work. But oftentimes you will hear that people are, I've heard outrageous numbers, like, I work 50, 60 hours a week. What? And I'm not going to tell anyone what to do, but I will say that that is above your pay grade. You're not getting paid enough to work that much. You should work hard. And sometimes you will work more than you should be working more than your contracted amount to meet like your own professional goals. But the reality is sometimes you have to, part of your professional development is learning how to say no. And that might not be saying no, mentor, I'm not going to do this thing you asked, but it may be, you know, no, I can't come into the lab on Sundays because, you know, that's my time set apart for my family or my religious time. I can't do things on Sundays. Or maybe saying, you know, I know you like to have meetings at 8 p.m., but that's when I have dinner with my husband. Like, I'm not going to meet then. Making sure that you set boundaries, because you still are, you know, your own growing professional and you're still your own adult. And you're more than work. Your life is more than your PhD. That's one piece of you. So make sure that you have boundaries in place so that you can be happy as happy as possible. Might not be happy every day, but as happy as possible as you go through your journey. Just learn how to set those boundaries early.
Yeah.
On that same note, self-care. This is kind of cliche, but I'm also in psychology, so you know I had to throw in a plug for self-care. You knew it was coming. Make sure that you schedule in time for yourself, doing things that make you happy. So I'm not that great at this, even though I'm giving a plug for it. But if you like to do things like read books, or maybe you like to work out and that really decompresses you, make sure that you set time for that. I know for me, like, part of my self-care is spending time with my family and my friends. And I'm like across the country, so I can't really see them right now. But in a normal non-coronavirus world, I would, you know, plan to go home, not often, but maybe, you know, 2 or 3 times a year, even just for a short weekend turnaround, because it really like fills me back up. Just seeing them, like, it gives me that push. You know, you go see your friends, they hype you up. They're like, hey, doc, you know, and that does something for me. And it keeps me going. So whatever that is that keeps you going, figure out what it is so that you can, you know, speak life into yourself and just have everything you need to be all that you're meant to be. You don't want to get burned out. Like, again, I'm going to say it a million times. You are more than your PhD. You're more than academics. You have your own life. So just make sure you schedule time for yourself. And my very last tip before Cliff puts me off his show is... My very last tip is to believe you belong and to act like it. You'll hear this concept often called imposter syndrome. Have you heard of it, Cliff?
Imposter syndrome? It sounds familiar. You can expand.
Yeah. More. So it's this, like, I never really heard it until I was getting ready to apply to school, but it's this like idea that you are an imposter. You know, you're not as smart as the other people you're applying to school against. You're not as smart as other people in your program. If you speak up, you might say the wrong thing, and then everybody will figure out that you're an imposter who doesn't really belong. It's this like almost like, I don't want to say out of body, but it's almost, you know, like an outsider looking in and like you're just lucky to be in the room. Mm-hmm. It's not true. And, you know, it's something for some people that never goes away. Like, I know full professionals with PhDs who still have, especially like early career people, they still have some level of imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. And so I would say, you know, I definitely had some of that when I was applying to school. You know, I was like, you know, what if the other people in the room have 50 publications and, you know, they have all this experience and then nobody will want me. It's not the truth. You wouldn't be there if you weren't qualified. Like, you're qualified. You deserve to be in that room. And so part of beating that is just believing it. And if you can't believe it, just fake it until you do believe it. You belong. Your opinion matters. Your research matters. And especially since this podcast is for the culture, I'm going to say sometimes the research that we like to do, if it's focuses on a specific population, some people might try to talk you out of it, or, you know, have you water it down or tell you that you should look more broadly. But your voice matters. Yes, you can learn from others and, you know, consider other perspectives, as you should. However, what you have to say matters, and you're there for a reason. So just believe it and stand firm and in your thoughts, and don't be afraid to speak up. If you're wrong, someone will correct you. We all get it wrong sometimes, but just believe that you belong in those rooms, because you do. So yeah. Those are my tips.
Mic drop.
That wasn't too long.
No, that was perfect. That was excellent. Yeah, I hear everything that you're saying, and I know I'm going to be brushing up against, especially that last part.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the nature of it is academia is a white space.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, how can you possibly fathom why I want to do this research?
Yeah. And even if you, it's so deep. That's one piece of it. But even when you get there, you know, I don't know if you've been following Black in the Ivory. These two great academics. I wish I could remember. Oh, you had Sharday Davis on. There's another young lady whose name I'm not remembering, but we can find it and maybe tag them. But they created Black in the Ivory, and it was just amazing to see how vast these experiences are. That even after you get there, and your research, you know, people might go along with your research plans, but your treatment sometimes is different. And just learning that despite how others might treat you or what they might say, you still very much belong. And it's your space too. And you're there to take up room, and you're going to do it well. So, you know, it's tough, which is why you have to self-care and set boundaries and all of that. But, you know, we'll all make it through with the community that we built with each other, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Joy, that's her name.
Joy, that's right. Thank you.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, man. So this is it. I feel like every time I do have a guest on, the same people are referenced, so everybody knows everybody. And so I'm hoping, right? You know, Black academia is knows each other. That's what I'm coming to understand. Black academia knows each other, mm-hmm. and using each other to lift each other up and help us move forward.
That's powerful.
Yeah. Cool. So thanks for coming. And you know, if you have, let people know if you want them to follow you on Twitter or something like that, or Facebook or Instagram, whatever it is, you can tell them.
Yeah. So I'm sort of still new to academic Twitter. But my handle is Lashae N Williams. So Lashae N Williams. And I just made a YouTube channel this week. Something I've been wanting to do for 2 years now, but I just kept putting it off because of imposter syndrome. I was like, nobody's going to want to hear what I have to say. But I have things to say. So I have a YouTube channel. It's live now. And it's Life with Lashae. Just Life with Lashae. I want one word for a username. Just look me up and follow me. I've got some good things coming.
Yeah, I'm about to follow it right when we get off this.
Thank you.
Cool. So yeah, thanks for coming. And if you know anyone that you think could share information with the culture, let me know. You can hit me up on Twitter or my email. And then we'll have them on, and they can share some of their genius as well.
I definitely will. And thank you for creating this space for us to come and share with others.
No doubt. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in. Check back sometime soon for more PhD tips. Until next time, peace.